cars, on having solar panels, especially in sunny parts of the United States. But certainly solar panels can work just fine in Canada, too, and get a lot of energy there. So I really want to see solutions implemented, and I'm passionate about that, and I hope to do more communicating and writing about that as we go hurtling forward into the mid-2020s.
We've been speaking with the worried optimist, Bob Henson. He's recognized as one of the best weather watchers out there and as a top science journalist. And Bob, where should listeners go to keep up with your work?
Well, I'm on Twitter, X, or whatever we call it, at B. Henson Weather. I'm also on Spoutable, also at B. Henson Weather. We'll probably be experimenting with some more platforms as time goes by. And also, yeah, folks can read up on my stuff at YaleClimateConnections.org.
That's where I've been tuning into your work. I love reading your stuff. Find links to the news and science we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much, Bob.
Thanks for having me, Alex. Great to talk with you again.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
In the United States, 40 local and state governments are suing fossil fuel companies for damages caused by climate change. In Canada, West Coast Environmental Law is leading the charge to make fossil fuel producers and emitters pay up. Environmental lawyer Andrew Gage coordinates the Sue Big Oil campaign. From Victoria, B.C., Andrew Gage, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Give us your impressions of the 2023 fire season in Canada's West Coast for our international listeners.
Well, I mean, where I am, we've been relatively fortunate, just some smoke occasionally, but, you know, clearly tens of thousands of people evacuated, many structures burnt in the interior. This is, in many ways, a repeat of some of the earlier very devastating wildfire seasons we've had. And, of course, it's also part of the national crisis that we're having this year with evacuations in the north and in other provinces, as well as just large areas burnt, and some record-setting burning wildfires. And certainly when I was a child, even until a few years ago, the idea that we would just have smoke-filled summers and we should expect a wildfire season was that was not something that happened for the most part. And now we're having them, seems like, pretty much every other year.
And when cities like Yellowknife or West Kelowna evacuate, it costs someone billions of dollars. Businesses shut down, firefighting budgets go through the roof, the military comes in, tens of thousands of people have to be fed and housed and get around, and then the super high costs of rebuilding kick in, and a lot of that big money comes one way or another from taxpayers. Andrew, who do you think should pay?
Well, I mean, the reality is we're all going to pay, but I think the question is, why isn't the fossil fuel industry paying at least some of it? And what is their fair share? This is an industry that has made hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars over the years, selling the very products that cause climate change. They've known that would be the result. They've actually worked very hard to delay anything that would move consumers away from using oil, gas, and coal globally. And yet they take no responsibility for the harm that their products and their actions in delaying that transition to a more sustainable energy source have caused. So absolutely. You know, our view is that it is self-evident that the fossil fuel industry, oil, gas, and coal, should be paying a share of those costs. And the question we should be debating is how much.
Andrew, why does this kind of case matter?
Well, I think that there's a couple of reasons. One is that our communities literally cannot afford the costs of preparing for climate change. In Canada, the Insurance Bureau of Canada estimates that local governments across our country should be spending $5.3 billion every year to prepare for the cost of climate change and minimize the impacts of climate change. We have not begun to wrap our heads around how we're going to pay for this. And, of course, the default, if we don't do anything, is that it comes at the expense of either higher taxes or cuts to services, or these necessary, you know, disaster prevention measures not being done. But equally, or maybe even more importantly, it's about making sure that the costs of climate change are on the balance sheets of global fossil fuel companies. Because we've seen what happens over the years when oil and gas companies and coal companies believe that they can make all the profits from selling their products, oil, gas, and coal, without taking any responsibility for the harm that they know they're causing. And that's why we've seen these misinformation campaigns. That's why we've seen companies peddling false solutions and lobbying against climate action and developing patents on, or holding patents, buying patents on renewable technologies that they never developed. Last year, or within the last year, BP, Shell, and Suncor, among others, have said, we can't afford to go ahead with our commitments on climate change because we're just making too much money from fossil fuels. And as long as you have that dynamic where this industry has all of the profits and none of the responsibility, they're going to continue making those types of business decisions that harm our planet and harm our communities. So this type of lawsuit, in addition to getting much-needed resources for communities to prepare for climate change and deal with the impacts, is really focused on, you know, how do we change the business dynamics and the perceived profitability of this industry that actually is a climate debtor and not a wealth creator? How do we make sure that that is seen? And that changes not just their own investment decisions and their own business decisions, but also the decisions of investors and governments that see this industry incorrectly, I think, as the goose that's laying the golden eggs, because they don't have to pay for any of the costs. So it's vitally important that we've come up with new and better ways to hold responsible anyone who's profiting directly from the destruction of the planet.
And do you see relationships between the history of public awareness of the tobacco to cancer link, and that was followed by huge liability suits, and public awareness of the causes of climate change, and then now legal action?
Absolutely. Not just tobacco also. I think asbestos, opioids. I mean, whenever there's an industry that has known that its products are going to cause massive harm, loss of life, these impacts, and have actively hidden that connection and tried to mislead the public and continue selling their products, liability generally has followed. This is not something exceptional. This is what we should expect. And I think it's because the oil and gas industry has done such an effective job of convincing us that this is somehow uniquely the consumer's fault and that they're just providing a product, that they've avoided this conversation for so long. But if we are all responsible for climate change, then the fossil fuel industry has to be also partly responsible. And they've managed to escape any responsibility and any conversation about what that responsibility is until these lawsuits.
So lawsuits against big oil, coal, and gas have a longer history in the United States in general, in sort of broad brush strokes. What is happening there and how is it going?
As you say, it goes back a few years. There were some lawsuits filed in the early 2000s that were unsuccessful because of legal issues that really don't arise in Canada for the most part. Questions about whether cases should be filed in state or federal court and whether the federal common law has been displaced by the Clean Air Act. And those cases, you know, were unsuccessful, and then there was sort of a lull for a second. And now we've seen a real resurgence of cases being filed by both local governments and states in state courts using a fairly wide range of legal theories, but generally coming back to these companies knew what their products were doing. They misled the public, and they've therefore contributed to the harm that local governments and state governments are experiencing now and will be experiencing in the future. There's now 41, I think, actually, communities that are part of one of these lawsuits one way or another, the most recent one being filed by Multnomah County in Oregon for about $50 billion U.S., so significant claims being made.
What can the legal history or what we've learned in the United States, can it help people and governments in other countries like in Canada or even the EU?
We can. A lot of the U.S. cases, at least the second generation of cases, has been tied up in technical issues about the level of court the cases should be filed in. And so only a few of them have gotten to really considering whether they have an arguable case, whether the oil and gas and coal companies have a case to be answered. But those cases are very informative. There's a decision from Hawaii confirming that the fact that the industry misled the public and was involved in this misinformation campaigns can in itself be, in addition to the harm they've caused by selling their products, this misinformation campaign can itself be a basis for claiming liability. There's also claims that have been filed in Europe, notably by Friends of the Earth Netherlands and by a Peruvian farmer, but in German courts against a German coal company, that have established that there are sort of arguable cases under European law as well. And those are also things that the Canadian and, it, I mean, I guess potentially U.S., but more likely Canadian courts might look to.
Well, tell us about the suit you and your group, West Coast Environmental Law, are launching in Canada.
Well, I'd love to say we were actually launching it just now, but actually the Sioux Big Oil campaign is pressing local governments to bring this case. I mean, basically what we're saying is, as taxpayers, as residents of these communities, we need our local governments not to just be passing the costs of climate change that they're experiencing on to us as taxpayers or us as members of the community, but to be seeking to recover those costs, taking the fiscally responsible step of actually looking for compensation and reimbursement of those costs from the industry that's done so much to cause those impacts. The alternative is we all pay 100% of the cost. So the Sioux Big Oil campaign is asking BC local governments to come together and file a class action lawsuit. We've had a couple wins in terms of local governments saying, yes, we want to participate in that. We'll put funds aside for it. But we're looking for a critical mass of municipalities to come together before the lawsuit will actually be filed. So it's not been launched just yet, and you know, we're hoping it will move forward quickly, but we've still got a ways to go.
Well, I like to keep our listeners apprised of the science behind a lot of this, and we have two studies that came from experts employed by the Union of Concerned Scientists. In 2017, Brenda Eckwurzel led the paper titled "The Rise in Global Atmospheric CO2, Surface Temperature, and Sea Level Emissions Traced to Major Carbon Producers." And that was followed in 2019 by Rachel Licker's look, "Attributing Ocean Acidification to Major Carbon Producers." Do you feel there are solid links directly from damages caused by, say, wildfires or flooding to the big carbon producers? Can we prove this?
Absolutely. I mean, and there's a third Union Concerned Scientists paper that was looking at the area burnt due to wildfires and linking back that back to fossil fuel production. The science that those papers are relying on or use you know, estimates the increase in the likelihood of these events and the severity of these events, and to what degree can that be tied both to climate change generally and then to the emissions that are traceable to these particular companies. It's extremely important work. That being said, a lot of the costs that communities experience from climate change are much easier to link than those particular extreme wildfires. You know, whenever a municipality has to put in a larger storm drain because climate change is causing more extreme precipitation during the winter, you can say, well, the increase in size of that pipe was actually tied to climate change. So there's a lot of costs that municipalities experience that are much less dramatic, but are no less real, and in fact, in many cases, are actually easier to draw that connection.
Yeah, that 2018 paper by Megan Kitchmer-Young at the Pacific Climate Impacts Consortium at the University of Victoria, she studied the record wildfire season in BC in 2017, over 1.2 million hectares burned. That's almost 3 million acres for our American listeners. And she found that, quote, anthropogenic climate change increased the area burned by a factor of 7 to 11 times. That sounds like a pretty big influence, all right.
It is. I mean, you know, in fairness, that paper does qualify that a bit in noting that there were other factors that weren't fully assessed. But I think it's pretty clear that you know, the impacts we've seen in 2017, as well as in 2018 and this year and in 2021, you know, I mean, we've got to say these are happening really frequently. There's a big connection there.
Well, one more to pass on to listeners. It's kind of the latest scientific smoking gun. It's a paper published May 16th, 2023 by Christina Dahl and her co-authors. And she says, quote, what we did in this study was attribute a portion of the increase in fire danger conditions and cumulative area burned across the western U.S. and southwestern Canada to emissions that you can trace back to 88 of the world's largest fossil fuel producers and cement manufacturers. What we found is that these fossil fuel producers and cement manufacturers are responsible for almost 40% of the area of western U.S. and southwestern Canadian forests that have burned since the mid-1980s, and they're responsible for about half of the increase in fire danger conditions that's happened over the last century. So that's a huge impact that you can trace right back to 88 named companies. We're talking about people like, I guess, Shell Oil and BP and the usual suspects.
Yeah, I mean, this paper, the paper you're talking about, as well as the other two you referenced, are based on the work of Richard Heaty, a scientist who's actually quantified how much greenhouse gases can be traced back to particular companies. And it's been really influential work, and the union concerned scientists and others are taking that in these directions and saying, if you take those figures, how much, you know, actual impact has that had on these different types of weather events?
How do you picture this case proceeding? What sort of damages might participating local governments demand?
Yeah, so we eventually want a lead local government, or more likely more than one, who actually have their names attached to the case. And they would be bringing the case on behalf of all BC local governments that are harmed by climate change. And the focus probably would be on the cost of preparing for climate change, because most communities, all communities, have those types of costs in common. One of the first stages of a class action lawsuit is that the judge will confirm that the case should proceed as a class action, and as part of that, that the case has legal merit, that the case could be won by the municipalities. So very early on in our process, we would get a ruling saying that the local governments could win, and that, you know, that presumably is going to be appealed. But at the end of the day, we would get a ruling saying, here's what local governments will have to prove in order to be successful, or not. If the judges and the courts were to rule that there wasn't a case, you know, we'd have to go back to the drawing board. But we're fairly confident that the answer will be yes, there is a case here. The judge would also certify what are known as the common issues, the issues that all of the municipalities have collectively, things like, are municipalities a proper plaintiff to bring this type of case? What type of damages can they claim for? Are the defendants appropriate defendants? What would they have to be proved to show that they were responsible? Questions about what each municipality might have be entitled to receive in compensation is not a common issue. That would be something to be dealt with at a further stage of the legal process. Now, one of the differences between Canada and the U.S. is the U.S. has a whole tradition of mass tort litigation with punitive damages being heard before jury trials. The Canadian context is quite different. It's generally not jury trials. The damages awards are, you know, I think, appropriate to the harm caused, but that don't include the same element of punishment. And so class action, you know, where the U.S. cases have generally been funded primarily by attorneys taking the cases on a contingency basis, a class action in Canada allows municipalities to pool resources to bring the case where they may have to put more of the funds up front otherwise.
So, Andrew, you were an environmental activist in BC, and then, as I understand it, after being arrested at Clackwood Sound on the roadblock to logging, you went back to university to become a lawyer? Is that the trajectory?
That's correct, yeah.
And then you're a member of the Society of Friends, also known as the Quakers. And you, in the early days of Radio EcoShock, I did a short piece on the gifts of the Quakers, from the right to assembly right up to inspiring and founding Greenpeace in Vancouver. It's a proud history. Talk to us about the role of environmental activism plays in your life and in your family.
I think I was raised believing that it is very important that we take responsibility for actions and that we take responsibility for our relationship to the planet and to helping each other, helping our communities, helping our each other grow. I went to university looking for ways that I could sort of be of help and leave the world sort of better than I found it. I think that comes both out of, yeah, just my upbringing, but also my sort of personal religious beliefs. And it's definitely a value that I've tried to pass on to my children and that our family tries to live as well. So, you know, my daughter's also been involved in climate strikes. She's now 17, and she carries on that sort of tradition of what can we do to help balance a relationship to the natural world that hasn't always been in balance.
All generations are going to have to take part in this if we have a hope of having a habitable planet, in my opinion. From West Coast Environmental Law, we've been speaking with lawyer Andrew Gage. He's helping to try and get going a lawsuit by local governments in Canada for damages against big fossil fuel producers. You can get links to the science we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. You can find out more about this campaign at www.suebigoil.ca. Andrew, thanks for your work in climate justice. We appreciate it, and thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
What are the scientists thinking? This is Kevin Anderson speaking in 2023.
If we think about where we're heading, let's be clear. We are over 30 years, 32 years now, since the first major scientific report on climate change that came out in 1990. And so I think when we judge where we are heading, we have to say, well, what have we done since 1990? Well, we've watched emissions go up year after year after year. They're now over 60% higher per year than they were in 1990. So there is lots that you will hear, lots of rhetoric, lots of good words, lots of optimism about the future. But given we've known about this subject and apparently been working on it for 30 years, the trend line tells us that we are heading towards 3 to 4 degrees centigrade of warming across this century, an absolute climate catastrophe. It's a catastrophe for all species, including our own. And so that's the direction of travel. Now, that direction of travel does not have to continue, but the current trend line tells us that all we are doing so far is giving rhetoric and optimism and greenwash and not driving the levels of change that are necessary to stay within the 1.5 to 2 degrees framing of the Paris Agreement.
So who is Kevin Anderson? For years, he was deputy director of the top UK climate institution, the Tyndall Centre. Anderson literally advised governments and the European Commission on climate change while fostering key research. He is a professor of energy and climate change, joint chair of the School of Engineering at Manchester. He's with the Center for Sustainability at Uppsala University in Sweden. He's been connected with Bergen University in Norway. And Kevin Anderson says we are on the path to climate catastrophe while we pretend otherwise. In previous shows with experts like Matthew England and Jason Box, find links in my blog, Radio EcoShock has reported the ice world at both poles is in serious retreat at a frightening pace. The Antarctic sea ice is so low, we don't know what is going on. With recent study, we know the great glaciers are melting at both poles. Sea level will rise, and much more than predicted. Your coming headlines in the decades will be coastal towns and cities retreating after mass damages. The vast food-producing deltas lost to salt will not be reported. The extinction of species from coral to microalgae feeding the sea creatures all around, that will not be televised. Millions of people fleeing the heat, drought, fires, and starvation will be on TV. Please listen again to my interview with Gaia Vince. That's in my April 26 show called Nomad Century and Bad Banks, available free at ecoshock.org, of course. Let's talk about the southern heat wave. Winter heat waves deserve more attention wherever they happen, even though humans enjoy them. This past July was the hottest ever experienced in Brazil. In August, it got worse, with temperatures soaring to 42 degrees C, 107 Fahrenheit, in the shade in winter. According to weather historian Maximiliano Herrera, the 45 degrees C recorded August 22 in Villamontes, Bolivia, ties the highest temperature ever recorded in meteorological winter in the whole southern hemisphere. Also in the southern winter, record highs were set in South Africa, from Cape Town, 32.9 degrees C, 91 Fahrenheit, to Namibia. Bob Henson mentioned the 30 degrees at Perth Airport in Australia recently, the hottest winter day at 79 years of record keeping. On all three continents, I guess people enjoyed the winter heat, but nervously. Their coming summer looks ominous indeed, as El Nino really kicks in. And those are just the reports from human settlements on land. The global sea surface temperature anomaly is literally off the charts from anything we have ever seen. That means the ocean is hotter, on average, around the world than ever before in human history. The North Atlantic is cooking, as is the Gulf of Mexico, where sea temperatures near Louisiana reached 90 degrees C hot tub temperatures before that last hurricane came. One place off Florida measured sea temperatures higher than the human body, above 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, 37 C. I can't call a scientist to find out what that means. Nobody knows. This is a whole new experiment with a closely connected web of living things inside of it. Who says we are going to fly well past the so-called guardrails of 1.5 degrees C or 2 degrees warming? Pretty well every major scientist I know, of course. A majority of the public suspect it. But only the oil and gas industry can guarantee we go to catastrophe. And they do. One of the world's largest oil and gas producers, ExxonMobil, says global climate goals are destined to fail. In late August, the company released its report called ExxonMobil Global Outlook, Our View to 2050. There's no apologies here. The Exxon researchers foresee a 25% increase in world population and a doubling of the global economy by 2050. The company plans to be there all the way, selling profitable oil and gas right past 2050 to fill demand for what they call, quote, a reliable and lower emission source of fuel for electricity generation, hydrogen production, and heating. Lower emissions? Then what? It's like the mafia saying the neighborhood is growing and people are going to want more drugs, more gambling, and sex. The mafia just fills demand more safely than those other gangs. Where companies like British Petroleum once promised to go beyond petroleum, the oil and gas majors are spending trillions on more production to last long into this century. Governments are not just helping. Governments are spending trillions of dollars to subsidize more drilling, more production. They're even approving more coal plants in the UK and in Australia. Can you believe it? More mines. Fossil fuel addiction has taken over the global brain network.
Well, the fireworks are over. Only the smoke remains, clouding my great crystal ball.
As I have said before, most of us will stumble on somehow until we can't. The universe will continue to reveal its secrets in fantastic galaxies and amazing new life. Love will not die. Art and song may flourish. The privileged few and the lucky will be glad to enjoy parts of life and the days. We may be passing through a step-like transition of terror with a couple of years where disasters pause again before the next jolt. I hope so, but we don't know. This was a pleasant and productive summer for me, although two cities next to our village almost burned down a month ago. In just a few hours, a massive wildfire roared out of the United States and ranged all above the hills over the desert town of Soyuz. It was one of the most frightening night images I've ever seen. Then another big fire flared up in the food-producing Okanagan Valley, causing the evacuation of parts of Kelowna. I tell you, the images on the local evening news were just terrifying. As the smoke rolled into our village, we might be next. We lost a big part of Canada to fire this year. Giant Arctic lands had to be evacuated, including the capital city, Yellowknife. People had to give up. You know, people talk about settling the Arctic during global warming, but humans had to run away while the fire ruled. It was only human to freak out. I'm still freaked out. Since 1988, I have tracked and recorded breaking science and weather news around the world. In the past 2 months, my collection lines were swamped. They just overflowed. My system broke down. My brain could not compute. It's all going to take at least a year to understand the weather shift that just happened and how much of it is permanent. But we may not get time for that. After Hurricane Idalia in Florida and Super Typhoon Saul crashed into Hong Kong and the Chinese mainland, and punishing heat storms all over, there will be another and another. Then it may be Australia's turn in the barrel. Who knows? Nature offered us a good survival niche for 10,000 years. It was like a kind of peace pact. We broke it. And now we find out what happens. In the next few weeks, I've got excellent guests lined up. Top experts speaking to you directly about their new work. Plus, there are a couple of crazy plots developing. For example, if we clean up air pollution, would that alone trigger fatal climate change? Please stay tuned. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world, all of it.